Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 342, recorded Friday, April 13th, 2018. Owen J.J. Stone, O-Docta. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life, and that's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Hello and welcome to Triangulation. This is TWiT's show where we sit down with people who you might recognize from the network. Also people, you know, passionate about technology, people who are very deeply ingrained in the technology sphere. We've had all sorts of guests throughout the years. I'm Jason Howell, and I'm sitting in today with someone who I can safely say, especially during my time producing Leo, there were a couple of years there where I was producing Leo's big shows, and obviously This Week in Tech is probably the biggest on the network, definitely the biggest on the network. And when I was sitting behind the desk as the TD for TWiT, there was one guest that I swear every single time he was on, I knew I was going to laugh. And, you know, like, I feel like it takes a lot for me to, like, laugh uncontrollably, but I'd be pushing buttons trying to hold the show together. And this guy, Owen J.J. Stone, O-Docta, was the one that you just, there's something about you that when I listen to you talk and your passion, both for technology and telling stories that were outside of the technology world on TWiT, you made me laugh, man. And I love it when I meet people that make me laugh, and you're just awesome. Thank you for joining me today on Triangulation.
Thanks for having me. Laughter is good. Laughter is key. It's it's very therapeutic. And, TWiT's one of those shows where I don't carry the tout of most of the guests that are on that show.
Yeah.
So I'm on there for a specific reason. I'm on for outside of the bubble living and comedic relief sometimes. Because sometimes technology gets a little too serious. And I can't stand that. It drives me crazy.
I can completely understand. But yeah, and I would say that your perspective on TWiT many times, and I think it's what I look forward to when I know that you're on the panel, like you said, it's very different from the standard, like, I'm a technology journalist and I cover this for a living. You can tell when you're talking about the stories that, you know, in many cases, you're talking about personal experience. You're talking, you've internalized a lot of this stuff, and I just love the way your brain works on analyzing these things from a different perspective than what we're used to hearing, the standard talking points and all that kind of stuff. You know that when I'm listening to you talk about a particular, you know, set of technologies, you're not just going to tell me that you think it's cool. You're gonna give exactly the reason and probably have a story to back it up. And you've just got a lot of perspective. And I think that's what I've always appreciated about your perspective on TWiT.
Yeah, it's nice being like in the bubble and having tech friends that I can geek out with.
Yeah.
And talking to a soccer mom that has no idea about anything and watching how they function, how they use a phone, how they use the application, what's most important to them, because that always just keeps me in check and gives me balance. I'm like, okay, you're telling me this is the most important feature, but regular people aren't using your service that way. So
yeah,
maybe if you were in touch with someone else besides a yes man at your company, you would understand how things are working. So it's nice to have perspective. So I appreciate you noticing my perspectives.
Absolutely, man. Can't deny it. Why don't we kind of, I've got kind of like a bunch of questions here throughout the history of you to that I'm curious about. I want to know where O-Docta began. Who was Owen Jr.? Who was O-Docta Jr.? Like, talk about yourself when you were a kid. Like, what really inspired you? What kind of a student were you?
I was a photographic memory student who failed the fourth grade because I couldn't show my work on all my math tests and exams. And the next year I had to take all my tests in the principal's office because they assumed that I was cheating, because I would learn the work in class. I'd look at it. I'd remember the answers and I just wouldn't do the work. So after that, I learned to at least fake do the work and get some answers wrong. I was a coastal student. I tried to work as little as possible, which I'm still living that lifestyle today. My dad was the technology guy. He used to be a mechanical engineer. He got injured. He couldn't work with his hands anymore. So then he went to computers. So I was the first kid on my block with a computer. I was first kid on my block with a typewriter with the digital screen on it, so I could read typing before you printed it out. And all the kids were at my house doing reports, and so that made me very popular.
I know which ones you're talking about.
Yeah, even before the computer, like that was technology.
Yes, that was. It was magical to hit enter at the end of that and watch it go.
Oh, catch when up I got that. I thought I was the coolest person in the world. Because, you know, typing nowadays, kids don't, or people don't type as well as they used to. I felt like everybody I grew up with could type, you know, 90 to 120 words a minute. Now people are chicken pecking at everything. But just having that, going from a regular typewriter to that, I thought I was the coolest kid. And I think it was like the seventh grade. And then the next year, my dad gave me one of his hand-me-down computers. I don't remember what it was. It was like a Targus or whatever that stupid thing was.
IBM clone of some sort, or
yeah, it was a knockoff because we didn't have money like that. So,
everybody had clones back then.
I had the floppy drives. I just found a whole stack of like Leisure Suit Larry.
Oh, yeah.
Like all the floppy drives and then the 3.5 cassettes. And I'm like, why did I even keep these? They're in pristine condition. I feel like I should send them to like a museum or something. I don't know why I still have them, but I can't bring myself to throw them away. So,
because that's gold. As far as memories of your childhood, at least I can speak from my own experience. I grew up with a Commodore 64. That was my machine of choice, you know, my first computer anyways. And having that huge volume, that like a plastic case with the rows of disks, like that was gold as a kid. That was memories right there. It's hard to get rid of that stuff. It's probably all disintegrating at this point, though. It's old enough.
Like I said, I had them wrapped in a box. I was about to throw the box on, like, this is kind of heavy, and they're just perfect. Like, but I have no way to read them or use them.
Right.
So I might just like put them in a picture frame or something. So somebody comes over, is like, what are those things? Well, let me tell you about the computers and the way we used to have to get information. It took 32 disks for 2 megabytes of memory. Like, so, but after that, I actually wasn't a real computer geek. I wasn't building my own computers or anything like that. Once that happened, my dad was building them for me. So I was really into video games and photography. And like I had first digital camera back in like 97. And I thought that was the greatest thing in the world because I didn't have to develop stuff and mess up. But the pictures are like this small when I go back and look at them. But I've always had toys. I've always had gadgets thanks to my dad and having a job. You know, I go to my dad like, oh, I want a PlayStation. He's like, you got a PlayStation job. You got PlayStation money. And as long as I earned enough money for half of it, he would always buy me stuff so I could play with it. And then I wouldn't destroy it because if I paid my own money, I took care of it.
Absolutely. There is so much to be said for that, for understanding, hopefully at a young age, the value of money. The fact that, you know, it's that old saying, money doesn't grow on trees. But you understand that saying when you have to earn it and then you spend it on something that's junk or you hate almost immediately and you realize it's too late. You only learn that through doing. So that's a good
lesson. And my first real job was working at my school during the summer, and I had to clean the gum off of desks and scrub lockers from kids writing in them. And for the rest of like my childhood career in school, I was all about stop putting that gum on the desk. Stop writing on the cabinets. Don't write on that. Like, cause I was like, somebody's got to clean that up.
Yes.
And it is disgusting. It gave me a whole new respect for school and the educational system and children, because that stuff was gross. But that was my first job where I actually got like a paycheck and they took taxes out and I'm like, where's my money? But it was a good job to have.
You said you were a gamer. So what was your first console like? How did you get into gaming? What kind of brought you into that world?
So the first console that I had was a joint console that was like my own, that wasn't my own. It was me and my cousins, and we had a timeshare going on back when we had a Nintendo. And literally, like, it would stay at his house for a week, and it would come to my house for a week. Or we'd be at each other's house every day anyway, so it didn't matter. And my dad had an Atari, But my dad was really weird. He wouldn't let me play the Atari because I think I got too excited. And I broke like two sticks. So after that, I wasn't allowed to play the Atari anymore. So
is that the 2600 or?
Yeah, the 2600. Okay.
Yeah.
So that was my jam for like a week until I broke one. And then he gave me another shot at it and I broke another one. And he was like, all right, you're done. You're back to, you can wait and push buttons. And that was a part of the reason why my cousin and I only got a timeshare Nintendo, because we were destructive.
Yeah.
We were breaking everything in the world. So,
well, in all fairness, those joysticks were not very good.
So. No, not at all. Especially when you're a kid and you're playing Pitfall and you think you're about to do it and you're not, it's really quick that you could just snap a stick. I don't know anybody else who really broke them like that. Every time I tell somebody, they're like, oh, what are you doing? I'm like, I don't know. I was getting a little excited and things would go crazy. But after that, I took a break off of games until I got, again, when I bought my first PlayStation, I think I was like addicted to Tomb Raider. I played for like 6 months straight where I didn't see the sun and what time it was. I wasn't worried about anything. Like, I thought that was like the coolest game in the world, where all the things actually worked out and it did things.
Oh, that game was such a journey too. Like, you could get lost in that game. For its time, it was such an adventure and such a great kind of sign of things to come. It felt like the next generation of games.
Yeah, it was the first game you played that was like a movie.
Yep, absolutely.
It had a good storyline. Obviously, it's a female character. When you're in like the ninth grade, you're drooling all over it anyway with your imagination, looking at the cover, as sad as that is. But, it had everything you needed to be like a killer game.
Yeah.
And that was like my favorite game as a kid. I could probably still play that. I just got the new one recently, and it has good nostalgia value to it. Now, I took a long break. I didn't buy any of the in-between games, but they brought it back. And now they got the new movie. The new movie I saw was good.
Yeah.
So, yay, Tomb Raider.
Right on. Do you find yourself, as you get older, like, I know for me, I was big into games when I was a kid. And, I mean, even into, like early college, right after high school, college, whatever. But then, I guess, life got serious. Or I'm not sure what happened, but definitely took a direction, a different direction, and then kind of fell out of gaming. And I've just never been as serious as I was when I was a kid. Were you able to kind of keep the fire lit for gaming in your life?
I do, but I also control myself because everybody's playing Fortnite right now.
Fortnite right now.
And it is a problem because of the camaraderie. So the only game that I guarantee buy and play for a consistent period of time is Call of Duty. I get it every year in November. I play it like a drug addict until like January. And then after Christmas, I put it down. Like after like January 2nd, I put it down. All the noobs get their game on Christmas. And after a week, everybody's got their golden guns. And it's just insane. So I just tell myself, look, you're going to die anyway. So you're not getting paid. You're not a professional. Put it down. And that's why I will not play Fortnite, because games like that will steal your soul. People out here not paying attention to their girlfriends, not paying attention to their kids. Their kids aren't paying attention to schoolwork. Like, I played the game once. I understand why it's fun. I can't do it. I will not. I don't play Fortnite. I try to stay away from it because I will dive into it. Certain games bring me back in,
Yeah.
I used to play Madden for money. I had to stop playing Madden altogether. I buy Madden like every other year now, and I'll play like a season or whatever, but I have to stop myself because when I get to playing, it's serious business. Like I said, if it's not making me money, I don't know how people could just spend a 30-hour work week on these video games, but they do it.
Yeah, I don't know how you fit it in. Like, I mean, I feel like as I get older, my free time only happens if I start waking up earlier and earlier or going to bed later and later. And at a certain point, you just hit a breaking point. Like, there's just no possible way to fit that in. As much as I love video games, it's just really hard to fit it in anymore. And I feel like that's the bummer of getting older, I guess.
You got an old soul. You can ruin your life and stay up a few nights.
I do. But all that goes into other things, too. It's not like that time is just free time, man.
You can just wrap it up into work. Tell Uncle Leo, I didn't come into work this week. I've been trying to figure out what's so important about this game. I want to do a good project. We can work it out.
That is kind of the benefit, the beauty of working in technology. And you can probably attest to this too, with your network and being close to technology from a show perspective, is that we kind of have the best excuse in the world to play with toys. Like, it's kind of part of what we do, is that people want to hear us and our opinions on these, you know, their technology, but they're also, to a certain degree, many times kind of a distraction, a toy, essentially. They're not always essential.
They're definitely toys. I always try to remind adults of that when they get on children about things. I'm like, look, your phone, you needing a new phone every year is ridiculous. You don't need the phone. You just want the phone. You want something to play with. Somebody sold you on the idea of how great this is, and you want it. And it's the same thing as watching a Garbage Pail Kid commercial when you were little, and you're like, I need to have that. You don't need, it's trash. It's a garbage doll, but you have to have it because the TV told you so. So it's definitely all relative about what toys are. When you're an adult, the toys get real expensive quick.
They do.
That's the issue.
They get expensive. They also get obtainable. And then you realize in retrospect, you know, maybe it wasn't the most mandatory thing that you could have done with your money. But I mean, you mentioned photography. Photography is can be a pricey hobby. I mean, the hardware, the technology behind that as a kind of a passion. Are you still involved with photography? Do you have a hard time kind of keeping engaged with that? You're obviously using a DSLR for this video shot because it looks fantastic. But
so I do a lot of photography and videography for clients, for my friends and family. I try not to do work. I try to do it as a hobby.
Yeah.
I do it for money sometimes, but I just love doing video. Like, I have two drones. I've had Canon for forever. They can never get me off Canon because I have like $30,000 invested in glass. So no matter what happens, every time I look at a Sony A7, I'm like, I can't do it because I'm not going to put attachments and use this glass. So Canon has my heart and soul, even though they're way behind in video. But their photography to me is the best. My house, I got all these pictures up. That's actually my pops up there. I threw them up on the wall. So I get all my good stuff printed up on canvases, and I throw them all around the house for myself.
That's awesome.
And super heavy into photography. I got secret Instagram accounts that if somebody emails me, maybe I'll share them with you. But I do a lot of photography, and I like it a lot.
And you keep your Instagram account that shares this secret. What is the reasoning behind that?
I have like 30 Instagram accounts.
Oh, wow.
So I have like four that just make me money. I have some that are just preparation to make money in case other ones get shut down. Then I have one that's for photography, secret. I do adult photography, like suicide model type stuff.
Okay.
And that's the one that's like hidden because, you know, people judge. I mean, I talk about my daughter all the time, and sometimes I have girls behind me wearing Superman or Thundercats, and people are like, oh, you're talking about your child, and you've got women on your wall. You're being disrespectful. And I'm like, modeling is a job. There are guys walking around without their shirt off, having their picture taken and put up on walls. It is what it is. It's not it's art to me, yeah. But I don't have time to explain all that in an email or a Twitter episode. So I just take it when people yell at me and say, why do you have girls on your wall or whatever. But it's more for the fact that they're wearing Thundercats and superheroes. If they were just girls in bikinis all the time, I wouldn't really have them up because that doesn't interest me. I'm more excited to see a girl in a Superman shirt.
See,
because I'm still a 5-year-old.
And now that you mention it, like I know in the times that, you know, I was TDing and we would have you on Twit, there would be those photos in the background. I just never realized how into photography you were and that those were
your
pieces.
Oh yeah, that's my work. So
yeah,
like
awesome.
Even that picture of my dad, it's fuzzy right now, but
yeah.
He's wearing a suit and I put it up. He's got this nice stuff. So it's one of those things. Again, I've had a camera since sixth grade. I had a camera and I was developing film myself. And then, like I said, once it went digital, I was so excited because I wasn't the greatest photographer when you start out.
Yeah.
So you have to spend so much money to find out that you suck.
Yeah, there's something to waiting also. Like even if you know you suck or you feel like you suck, it's really cool to have to wait for it. And then when you get it back, find that diamond in the rough and be like, that's what you were waiting for.
The real good thing about that is 5 years ago, I rented a 35mm camera and I took pictures. And I sent them out to get developed. There is something exciting about waiting. And the best part about that is now I'm elite and a master of the camera system. All my pictures came out dope. Like, everything was great. I was super excited, and I was like, wow, I'm still not going to do this because I got to pay for it, but I know that I have the skill set to do it now, as opposed to when I was younger, I would get lucky, because back then, you know, it wasn't, there weren't a lot of classes and things like that, especially when you were young. I was lucky to even get a camera at that age. So it was what it was.
This is what it's like to have a full row, a roll of exposed, awesome pictures. That's fantastic. What was the digital camera? Do you happen to remember your first digital camera? I know mine was a Mavica, but it was a few years later. It was like a 2000, in the year 2000, and it took 3 1/4 floppy disks. It was one of those big format ones.
So that was my second camera. I had a Sony. I forget what the version was, but I had the Sony version of that. And then my third camera was the Sony with the discs, where it would burn it right on the disc inside. Yep. Mm-hmm. I thought I was special. But the first one I had was like, it might have been like Pentax first camera. It was a little, looked like a little candy bar. And it was flat and it was tiny and it was crappy. But the coolest thing about it was you could flip the screen inside of itself. So the lens was on this side. You could rotate it so you could take the pictures. And I was like, before Nikon came out with that, stole that idea and stuff like that. Somebody stole it from me. Oh. You know, when you're a kid, you're in high school and you got cool stuff. I think I had it for a year and then somebody stole it out of my locker. And then I had to wait like another 2 years before I got the first Rebel digital camera. So, America.
What about the internet? What was your first experience with the internet? How young were you when you finally had the chance to kind of check out this new thing called the internet?
So I was on the internet in 1996, and again, talk about addiction. The first thing I got introduced to actually wasn't even AIM. Like, I had AIM in chat room, and my friends were on it, but I met a girl on a bus to New York, and she was like, oh, you should get on ICQ. And I'm like, I don't know what that is. We have AIM. I don't know. She's like, get on ICQ and come into this chat room. And I was in a chat room where it was a vampire fantasy where you had to create, you were a vampire you wanted to be. And I was just up there, you know, we were killing each other. It was World of Warcraft before World of Warcraft and ICQ. And it, like, that took a lot of my time, because one, I had to, you know, you're on dial up. So you have to wait till 9-10 o'clock at night, and then I had to sneak on it, because one, I wasn't allowed to be up that late. I was too young. Two, you couldn't be on the phone to be on the internet, because if I was on the phone, I'd get yelled at. Like, why is the phone busy?
Yeah.
So that was ICQ was like my first like real, like, I'm out here thinking I'm computing. I'm in these chat rooms, I'm jumping around these worlds, you know, I got multiple users. And that was my first like, oh, I'm on the internet. We're doing it. That was the sad part too, is again, that's where I stumbled into a ring of people that were just sitting around penthouse and Playboy model pictures. And I like take 3 days to download a picture just to delete it, because again, I'm not supposed to be looking at that stuff. I can't keep it on the computer. So I get it, download it, wait like 3 days to get it just to look at it. Like, oh, that's crazy. And then I have to make sure I hit the delete button. But yeah, ICQ, I just found a picture of a screenshot that I took of an ICQ chat of an old friend. And I was like, man, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Like, that's like a 25-year-old, you know, chat session going on.
Yeah.
But, that was my first dabble into the World Wide Web. Cause you know, AIM, you know, you're talking to your friends down the street. I might as well just ride my bike over there. That didn't matter to me.
Yeah.
But ICQ was, I just met so many people, and I ended up meeting a lot of people in real life. Like, once I graduated, like, I met like 5 girls that I've been talking to for like 4 years. Once I graduated and I could travel, I met somebody in Miami, I met somebody in Puerto Rico. Like, I've known them for like 6 years, and I'm like, where you live at? Let's hang out. So that was my big deal. And then after that, I guess the most important thing I started doing on the internet was in 2000, I made a site. What IQMZ means is Inquire Minds Media. So I had inquireminds.com, and I did surveys that I would sell to Maxim Online and stuff like that. And they would send me like $200, and I'd make these surveys. And that was like my first like, wow, I can make some money on the internet. This is cool. Kind of deal.
That's a powerful realization to make. What kind of inspired the move into creating this site? Was it just that you were at that point so familiar with the fact that you were visiting all these sites and that you could actually be responsible for a destination for someone? Like, where did that come about?
So I'll tell you a great story about parenting and how you support family. Okay. So in the 10th grade, I made a survey. Now, sadly enough, I was a pervert. It was a sex survey. The front side was for guys, the back side was for girls. And it was literally like, do you like kissing? What's your favorite thing about a person, their personality, their eyes, their butt, all this stuff, right? And I passed it around the whole school. I had minions that were doing the work for me. I didn't really pass it out. I got ratted out about this survey, and I went to the principal's office, and I signed my name on the bottom of the survey in Wingdings. So the principal calls me in. They're like, oh, we heard you passed the survey. I didn't do anything. They called my dad in. My dad's like, why are you calling me here? Like, well, somebody said that Owen is responsible for this. And he was like, well, do you have any proof? They're like, no, we're waiting for you so we can go search his locker. And so they search my locker. They don't find it. And my dad just looks at me. He's like, give me a moment with my son. And I was like, all right. He comes in. He's like, you wrote that, did you? I'm like, yeah. He's like, you put your name in Wingdings, you dummy. And I was like, yeah, I did. Because he counted the letters. He already knew it was my name. Because I've been calling myself Owen J.J. Stone since like the sixth grade. Anyway.
Did he know Wingdings, like, at that point?
Again, my dad was a computer guy.
That's like, true.
He was working for Compact at that point. You know, he was supervisor there. So he knew exactly, like, once he counted the numbers up. So he's like, did you do it? I said, yes, Dad, I did. He's like, all right, well, just shut up. And he called the principal back in. Principal's like, look, you ain't got no proof my son did it. He said he didn't do it. I'm going back to work. Call me when you get some proof. So he goes home, and I didn't get caught. End of the day, I get all my surveys back, and everybody filled them out. And then they wanted to know where you could find it at, the answers. I had nowhere to put the answers. A couple years later, my friend that helped me pass them out was like, Maxim has these survey things like you had. He's like, why don't you email him and send him your survey with all your results? And that's what I did. I was like, oh, I did this back in the day just in case you want some stupid numbers of young people. And they're like, oh, could you do that again and put it on the internet and send it to us? I'm like, yeah. And so I did. And they sent me money. And I did like three or four of those. And then I realized I really like the internet.
Well, particularly when they're sending you money. Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
It's a crazy story. It's a crazy story, especially not to get caught. And, again, everybody knew it was me because, everybody knows what's going on in school. But only one person ratted me out. She's now a regional manager at McDonald's. Yes, I keep tabs on her. I want to know where she's at all times because she snitched on me. She's doing pretty well in life, unfortunately, unbeknownst to my thought process of downfall for her. But she's doing good
since then. Yeah.
Yeah. She's doing good.
What's the worst job you ever had?
Probably at the school. I've been very fortunate. I did my job after that was at Kmart developing pictures. So again, I got to develop my film and I got a discount.
That's
and
great.
I got to see everybody's pictures. And sometimes back in the day, see, I sound like a pervert. I'm telling you all the dirty stories. But like, you know, when you're like 17 and you're developing pictures, you know how people used to have to get their pictures.
Yep.
So when they would take pictures, you'd be like, whoa. Like, okay. You know, and I would never rat anybody out because I always thought to myself, man, I don't want nobody to rat me out. I had already been ratted out at that point. So, you know, I always developed people's pictures for them. And that was like a good job. Then after that, I worked UPS for my uncle, which transformed me into buying a UPS store with him and my cousin later. Damn. So I really haven't had too many jobs besides working for myself because IQMZ.com started in 2001 when I made it official. And then in like 2003, people can't spell. So I turned it into IQMZ.com. And it's been that as my main core job ever since. Back then, we used to do websites. Everything was in Flash, which was horrible because you spend a whole week coding something just to make a squiggly line, do this. We used to sell apps to MySpace. When people used to put them on their main page, we had music players, yep. Games. Like, we would sell, like, little units on MySpace to people, and we make them custom. Then I went into party and club promotion. I sent you that stupid picture with me sponsored by Budweiser and stuff like that. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. we would go out to local clubs and parties and then take pictures and then put IQMZ on it. And you go to IQMZ and would have all the MySpace modules where people could go get them and get the games. And the pictures were like, I've always used leverage. Yeah. So if I could go to clubs and stuff and say, oh, here's where you can go check out these pictures, they'd go there and maybe they'd want to give me like $5 to put something on their MySpace, or they know somebody like, oh, these guys make a cool website, you should hire them, type of deal. So that run lasted for like a good 7 years until like 2007. Then that's when I turned into vlogging and digital marketing and transferred into that whole jazz. I was the number one doctor in iTunes for podcasts. I was over Dr. Phil, Doc Savage. Doc Love emailed me and said, oh, what kind of doctor are you? Who are you? I'm like, oh, I'm not a doctor. I'm just, oh, doctor. But my the thing that was cool back then was there weren't that many podcasts. So just by me doing a show and I, you know, having the technology people on and I was answering people's questions the way I answer them, you know, crazy and whatever. I'm not a doctor, so I'm not giving you this stupid answer. I got to call myself the number one advisor on the internet. Because for a good like year, I was the number one doctor on iTunes podcast.
So there was a category they do this in iTunes, and I'm sure they still do, where they break out subcategories of different curated lists. Did they just pull you in? Obviously they pulled you in primarily because you had doctor in the name, but there was no consideration to the fact that you weren't actually a doctor. It was just like, nope. Oh, great, qualifies.
It probably was just the way the algorithm pulled it in because sometimes I would write doctor because people can't spell. So sometimes I would put doctor, I would put doctor, like all my tags had a lot of doctor stuff in it.
Yeah.
And I was given advice. So it was like, you know, back then all the podcasts, that's what Dr. Phil did, were advice columns, basically, where they would just, you know, have people send in stories or articles where they talk about stuff, have guests on and they would interview them. So they just lumped me right in with those guys. And at the time I was on and popping because at that point I was doing 5 shows a week, and that was my flagship show. I was doing a music review, a movie review, like my DocTales thing I do now is like I used to call Friends Up Friday. Every Friday I would interview somebody. So I was doing a whole bunch of stuff.
I know him. Yeah. DocTales with Godfather Robert Ballester.
There you go.
So, Sarah Lane. There we go.
Yeah. So I should get you on. See? Turnabout's fair play.
Let me know. I would love to join you.
But that was... that was the thing where I found that, again, leverage. If I could get in front of people with the podcast and they saw what I was doing, that got me a lot of website work, digital strategy work. And then the more I worked up, I remember, you know, it's a leverage thing. I remember the first time I interviewed Gary Vaynerchuk, and before Gary was Gary, and it meant something that I had Gary on my show. Because Gary had only done his own show, or he was only on Dig Nation and things like that. Like now, Gary, he'll, you know, he doesn't do it as much now because he's too big.
No, he's got his own thing. Yeah,
he used to do everybody's show every day all the time. But before that, I was like one of the only people that interviewed him. You know, I got Kevin Rose early on. I got Jay Adelson early on. And that's the stuff that parlayed me into getting actually on Twit. I was at South by Southwest and somebody introduced me to Lisa. And, you know, 5 minutes of talking to me about technology, I made her laugh. She was like, wow. She's like, you are like funny. Like, you should come on Twit. And I'm like, sure. What's Twit? And I knew what Twit was, but I didn't know what Twit was.
Yeah.
And next thing I got on Twit, and yay, me still being on Twit.
Absolutely. Now, circling back to IQMZ now, are you still kind of doing the website advising aspects of that? Is that kind of the primary focus at this point?
So, yes, again, leverage. I do podcasts, interviews, and shows just to keep IQMZ into doing something. I'm the worst person at selling myself. That's why when you went to go look me up, I would let things die. I used to have askodoctor.com. It was ranked back when my podcast was big. Then I had odoctor.com. I had Inquiring Minds. Like, I let that go. Now I just use IQMZ. Like, so as far as my legacy goes, once it's done, it's done. If you want to go search and find, you'll find some of the old podcasts on old YouTube. Like, I've got episodes with 200,000 views on it. Now you look at my new channel, you're like, oh, this guy's only got 30 views on an episode. To me, reinventing myself and changing what I'm doing is for me personally, because the work that I do, I get referrals. Mm-hmm. You know, people call me and they're like, oh, well, do you have a website where I can go to reference, blah, blah, blah? And I'm like, well, who sent you to me? They obviously told you I do good work. You wouldn't have called me if you didn't believe them. We could work together. I could tell you what I do. We can get it done or we don't, because I'm not really good in the business of selling myself. As much as I love to talk and goof around and tell stories, I dislike throwing myself down people's throat. I'd rather push someone else's product, especially when it's a good product, it's a good app, it's a good story. So that I use that as leverage just to stay relevant and in the mind's eye of people so I can get some referrals.
Let the work speak for itself. I feel the same way. I feel very strange about promoting yourself, and you know, like going through school, you know, for media and all that kind of stuff, they stress the importance of networking and really getting out there and proving why you, and that just always felt weird to me. It's like, let the work speak for itself.
So the networking part is the part that does matter. You want to network. You want to have the people know you and know your value. It's the part after networking when you're reaching out to people that you don't know. So my whole general premise is one, everybody who knows me generally, you know, just say something good about myself. I'm a straight shooter. If I think your idea or your project sucks, I'm going to tell you it sucks. I don't need the money. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. So people value that from me. And even people that don't know what I do for a living, which most people don't, you don't know what I do technically for a living. They'll say, oh, you need a website or some social stuff. Ask Owen. Owen, you know, I don't know what he does. But just ask them, tell them your project, tell them what you're trying to do. And what ends up happening is if I can help them, I help them. If I can't, I point them in the right direction. And even just doing that solid always brings me back work for other things. So networking is good. It's just the part of reciprocating and respecting your network and building it that has value.
Yeah, I guess when I say networking and
I know not, what you meant. Not I know enjoying, what you meant. I just wanted to clear it up.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate that. It just for me, what I defined as networking back then versus what I understand it to be now, which is really just kind of being your authentic self and, you know, and just talking with people and being real. Back then it felt much more like a process, like a salesmanship process. Like, I'm networking, I'm going to sell myself to, you know, sell somebody on the thought of me. And that I never really cared for. I've learned differently over the years that it's not quite that. It doesn't have to be that anyways. And yeah, it sounds like obviously that's worked very well for you.
I also live in, again, I don't live in the bubble. I've had job offers in San Francisco and New York, and I'm like, one, I have a kid. I like living in my little, I live in like one of the smallest towns in New Jersey. So I can do a project and afford to live here. If I was in the city, I'd be killing myself working all the time. If you're like, oh, if you worked and did more, you'd be rich. And I'm like, yeah, but then I'd be working all the time. And not for nothing, I'm enjoying the benefit of coaching my daughter's team. She's got 3 games next week. I'm going to be at all the games. I'm at all the practices. When I miss a game or practice, she's like, the world ended, because she's like, what's going on? You're right. Like, what happened? So I enjoy that time because now she cares about me. Like, 3 years, she won't give a hoot and or Annie about me, and I can go on and go do what I want to do. But right now, she's at the age where, you know, me being around is a bonus.
Absolutely. For both of us. And that's something that shines true through on the appearances on the network, you know, where I've seen you on Twitter or wherever, that's a discussion topic that seems to kind of come in there. Like I was saying earlier, you talk a lot about your personal experiences, which really informs your perspective on technology. And a lot of times that includes your family. And I've always really appreciated your approach on that. Actually, let's talk a little bit about that. Before we do, though, we have to take a quick break. We have to thank the sponsor of this episode of Triangulation. Then we can kind of talk a little bit about your views on technology and family and go from there. This is such an awesome episode. I'm really happy to be talking with you, Owen. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. If you've done the mortgage process, if you've experienced it, or maybe you haven't, maybe you've just heard about the process. It's not the easiest thing in the world. It's definitely over the years has not kept up with the times, you know, kept with the digital age and this kind of promise that the digital age is going to make things easier, not more difficult. Well, it was dated. It needed that technological focus, that client-focused revolution. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence that you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. They keep it simple. That's going to allow you to fully understand all of the details involved and be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. You keep it convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. It's also very powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in seconds, all based on your income, your assets, your credit. Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of those and then take a look at all the home loan options for which you qualify and then find the one that's just right for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. You can get started by going to rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. That's rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of this show. Talking with Owen J.J. Stone, O-Docta. By the way, you mentioned it a little bit earlier. O-Docta, like, how did you pick that name? It sounded like you had it from early on. What was the premise behind that?
Found out actually through Uncle Leo what O-Docta meant. My friend Brian DiRico, give him shots out, 7th grade. Again, being a heavier set kid, I used to write poetry. That's how I used to get the ladies. And I was always good with words and girls. So everybody would always come to me for advice and all that drama that goes on in middle school, high school. And my one buddy was like, man, he's like, man, you're the doctor, man. You just fix everything. All you do is fix everybody. You just know how to talk to people. You know people. And he's like, and then he just starts calling me O-Doctor. He's like, O-Doctor, every time I come to lunch table. And then it just stuck. And I just thought that Brian was like some magical unicorn being that came up with this great name. And Uncle Leo one day on the episode said, O-Docta. And I'm like, oh, you said like my buddy says. He's like, oh, that guy was a baseball broadcaster. And every time someone hit a home run, he'd say, O-Docta. Brian DiRico is an avid, rabid baseball fan. So it must have seeped into his brain as a child. And then he stole it, claimed it as his own, pawned it off on me. I've been giving him credit all this time, but really it was attributed to that broadcaster. So that's where the O-Docta thing came from.
Dang, and you went all those years not knowing the premise behind that until Leo.
Yeah, I think up until like 5 years ago, I never knew. I just thought Brian called me O-Docta every time. Rico used to call me O-Docta. I don't know. He's O-Docta. And Leo said it just like how he said it, because he would say it when there was home runs or like a stolen base. We'd be like, O-Docta, what a run. Like he would do it like that. And Leo did. I was like, that's weird. So that's where that came from, apparently, a baseball broadcaster.
Are you a baseball fan?
I am not.
You're a football fan.
I'm a football fan. I'm a basketball fan. I like baseball when I go to the games. I can't watch it on TV. It bores me. It doesn't interest me. Yeah. I can watch my daughter's softball games. I can go to those games. I can watch. I love going to the game. I just can't watch baseball. I can't watch golf either for that same reason.
Philadelphia Eagles, if I remember correctly, right?
Yeah, that's my main team, but they don't pay me, so I'm a fan of football. This is actually a Cardinals jersey I'm wearing right now. I love everybody that's not my division, so the only football teams I hate are the Redskins, the Cowboys, and the Giants. Yeah. Everybody else, I'll watch them because I just like the game.
Yeah, well, I've always been, well, not always, but I've been a fan of the Philadelphia Eagles for probably about 10 years. 10 years now, because when I was getting into football, a friend of mine who was incredibly passionate about football was the one to kind of bring me into the fold, and his team was Philadelphia Eagles. So it's like I adopted them just by default through him. So the Super Bowl win was very satisfying, and I'm sure it was a million times more satisfying for you than it was for me.
Oh, I'm not going to go get my Eagles squawking hat over there, but yeah, I was a happy guy. I actually watched with my buddy Drew Olenoff. Yep. His father passed away. My dad passed away. So we watched it together. Our dads didn't get to see the Super Bowl, but we got to watch it together. And it was a happy, happy day.
Right on. Awesome. So I said we were going to talk a little bit about kind of family and technology, because I think I'm just always fascinated by this. Obviously, I'm a dad. I have an 8-year-old and 4-year-old daughter, and they're, you know, our 8-year-old is definitely old enough for this, but our 4-year-old, almost 5, she turns 5 in like a week. you know, I'm at this point where I'm really kind of trying to make sure that I make the right decisions as a dad as relates to technology, because technology just plays an incredible level of importance in everyone's lives nowadays. And I felt like technology was a big deal when I was a kid. It's even more of a big deal now. You have you know, gone through a lot of this yourself. How do you approach technology with your daughter? What has kind of been your approach, your strategy over the years?
Give her everything that she can have and then set rules and parameters around it from the beginning. So my daughter's had a phone, an iPod Touch or an old iPhone since she was four. Her own device, like just giving her have it, will, whatever she wants it. And the trick to that is, one, she has to, when she goes to bed, it's her music device. So I know she's not up all night playing it because I can always hear the music playing.
Yeah.
No music, there's a problem. I go in, why are you on your phone? So that always kept her in check, kept the rules and bounds for that. Secondly, we're in the car, no phone in the car. I kept comic books and, you know, coloring books and stuff in the back seat. So now we get in the car, no device. And she's at the point now where she's 11 years old and she just walked in here a second ago and asked for a phone. Where if I say, give me your phone, she doesn't say anything. She doesn't do something she's supposed to do. I take her phone for a day. Like, and she doesn't cry, doesn't acquiesce. She has to post on Instagram every day. We have a whole system in place. She's never lost or broken a phone because she follows the rules. So if you have the time to actually pay attention to your kid and set the rules and enforce the rules, that's the biggest problem. You got to enforce the rules, especially if you have a kid that's a crybaby, let him cry. But luckily, my daughter's a beast, so she doesn't. But you got to enforce the rules. That's actually the number one thing after every episode of Twit. I get questions about the kid and technology. So I'm actually, if I get myself together, I'm going to do a Raising a Ninja podcast where I talk to the kid about stuff and little tricks that I do to teach her things. Like here, I'll tell you a fun one. That's not technology invested, but it's something good for your kid.
All right.
You ever send a kid to go find something and they come back with three different things besides what you asked for?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. So every time it's over there, I don't feel like going to get it. Every time I say, go get the red pencil off my desk, and she comes down with a pen, a book, a rock. So that's three times, right? I have little books of word search. So every time she comes back with the wrong item, that's a page of word search that she has to do. 20 words. She's got to sit there and find all the words, and she can't have her phone until she finishes the word search. So if it took you three trips and three times wasted my time, then you got three word searches to do. It kind of kicks itself into gear where they don't want to go not finding what you asked for. She's at the point now where I say, go get the red pencil. She looks at me. She's like, the red pencil on your dresser, right-hand side of your bed? Yeah. And, yeah. Because before, you know, a kid will just take off. They act like they heard you, but they just run.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But just that little trick right there has slowed her roll. She still makes mistakes. Everybody does. But that's a way of, quote unquote, punishment where I don't have to yell. I don't have to get upset. Yeah. I'm like, all right, well, that's two word searches you got to go do. So the same thing with technology. When she has her phone, she has to do 25 push-ups and 25 sit-ups every day. I pay for this phone. A phone is not free. It's a $1,000 device. She has an iPhone 6 Plus right now. And I had to pay for it. I had to pay monthly for it. So every day she has to do push-ups and sit-ups. She told me she wanted to do photography. I got her camera. So you got to post on Instagram every day. Things that I can check on. You don't post on Instagram every day, I take your phone for a day. You don't do your push-ups and sit-ups, I take your phone. Because if you don't pay your bill, you don't get a phone. So there's all kinds of things I attach to technology where it makes her respect the technology and she doesn't take it for granted. She's not allowed to use it in school. Phone turns off. Phone doesn't turn back on during school. I don't have to check it because she's, like I said, she's a good kid. But every once in a while, I check to make sure there's no text messages sent out in the middle of the day. And because when she gets home from school, her phone blows up because kids are sitting right across from her in class or trying to text her because they know she's got a phone.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you're in the fifth grade. Why are they texting in class? Like, what could be so important they couldn't walk over and tell you at lunch? So, but those kids don't have rules. And those are the kids that will freak out later on when you try to take their phone and they say, this is my phone. Wait a second. Did you pay for this phone? Yeah, you paid a bill on this phone?
Because that age seems to be going back younger and younger and younger. And it's, you know, it's a lot to ask. It's a lot to ask of a, let's say, a third grader that if you send them with a phone to school for whatever the good reason is that you're doing it, you know, you want your child to have a way to contact you, whatever that reason is, it's a lot to ask of a third grader to have the mental fortitude to, or the, you know, kind of the, to be able to resist that temptation to do all of the other things that you know you can do with a phone if you have one.
And super pro tip, like I said, I got to do this podcast because I feel like it might make me $1 billion as like one of the world's best parent. I can go tour the nation. But when I first gave her a phone when she was four, I gave her a bag. And it was a small, like, over the satchel bag that basically fit her phone like a small notebook. Here's the rule. No phone, no bag. Basically, it's a purse, but I wanted it so when she went to play and stuff like that, she could still wear it. But no phone, no bag. No bag, no phone. So when she's at a friend's house, and she'd walk out, she'd be like, where's my bag? You know, and she'd make sure her phone was in it.
Yep.
If she left her phone somewhere, it had to be together. So that's prevented her from losing the phone, from breaking the phone, because she always has somewhere to put it in. That's not her pocket. Like, she always has this bag with her. And no phone, no bag. And it's worked out for 6 years now. She has had one broken device. Oh, and obviously, after the iPod Touch, her first phone was like some Android One. Not Android One. OnePlus phone. That was like the first phone I gave her because I wanted to, you know, give her a $100 phone, see what happens. But she went a whole 2 years, didn't break it, so I got her iPhone.
Nice.
And, you know, you got to slowly, gradually upgrade the kids and what you're giving them. And smaller form factor is better. Tablets, they break tablets because they drop them. So you can get them something in their hand, good. And if you take it away from them, that's the biggest thing. You got to take it away from them. You can't just – well, my kid's a unicorn. But most kids, you have to say, okay, here's that. All right, you're done.
Right.
And watch stuff with them. The thing that kids do now, talk about being in a bubble. My daughter had three friends over. All three of these girls are laying in her bed watching Pat and Jen on her phone. She's got a 50-inch TV in her room hooked up to a Google. And she can say, hey, Google, play Pat and Jen on the TV. Turns on a TV, starts playing Pat and Jen. And I'm like, why are you all sitting here looking at this little screen and not watching the TV? It's the weirdest thing how they're like.
That's the screen that they're most, I don't know, but most connected with. It's just a different paradigm. Were they all watching the same screen?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, like the other two were playing a game or something, but like she was in the middle, had it in her lap, and they're just watching it. And I'm like, you could just put it on the TV and everybody could really watch it and you could still play your games or do whatever else you're doing like on the phone. Like, what are you doing? Yeah. And every time I say it, they're like, you're right. And then the whole rest of the night, they'll have it on the TV. But I have to literally remind them that they have another device that's like way bigger. So it's very interesting how kids, especially girls, utilize their phones.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. What about social? So it sounds like she has an Instagram for her photography and stuff. Is that like to what degree are you comfortable with your daughter being on social media at this stage?
So she has @Leah on Twitter. She has Leah.com, which basically is essentially a Tumblr page, which I need to relink up because I switched hosts, so it's broken. But she has Leah.com, same name as her Twitter. She has Instagram. She has Snapchat. And that's it. And again, lucky me, being involved in my kid's life and also not freaking out about things. Once a week, we sit down and I'm just like, oh, give me your phone. I scroll through her messages. She's like, oh, this girl is crazy talking about this. Da, 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 da. Oh, this kid likes such and such. And she'll just talk me whole through her whole thing. And we read it together. Same thing with her Instagram. Somebody messages her. She's not locked up. She's not private. But we have such a good relationship to where, again, she just gives me her phone. And again, if a boy messages, like this one boy likes her, whatever, my daughter's beautiful. I get it. You know what I mean? And he's sitting there trying to text her like, oh, you know, she's like, he likes me. I'm like, I could tell, you know, but I don't sit there. What are you doing talking to a boy that likes you? Because then she won't share with me.
Right.
And until I have to worry about it, you know, I understand that kids, you know, had their little crushes or do whatever they're going to do. And so she trusts me. That I'm showing trust to her. So as far as that's concerned, my daughter could be anywhere she wants on the internet because I'm on top of it. That being said, that's why I have so many Instagram accounts. On my own Instagram, I have to be like super PC dad now because so many of my friends don't follow their kids. I follow like 20 or 30 of my friends' kids, and I'm like, oh, how'd your kid wake up for school today? She's like, oh, she was tired. Why? I'm like, because she was up till 2 o'clock in the morning posting on Instagram. So you might want to check her on the school night. He's like, oh, I don't know nothing about that. Thanks. You know, I'm a snitch. I know I am. It's horrible. But another instance, one of my friend's daughters, who's 15, was getting catfished by a 30-year-old guy trying to get her to send him nudes. And I saw this guy comment on her stuff all the time. And I was like, you might want to check into this guy. Ended up being an older dude. But some parents don't know what to check for, or know what their kids are doing. So I try really hard to. And they don't talk to their kids about it. They're like, oh, you're on the Snapchats or Insta whatevers, whatever. And they don't think that it's bad. But I always try to tell them, like, what kind of stuff were you doing on AIM? Like, don't you remember people trying to get you to come to their house and do it? Oh, yeah, you're right. I'm like, yeah, freaks have been out on the internet and everywhere. Back in the days, have a van before the internet, you know, free candy. Yep. So it's like, you got to check on your kids. So I spent a lot of time policing for my other friends as well, as far as the internet is concerned. But my kid, you know, she gets annoyed. She has to post on Instagram every day. But I'm like, hey, you want this camera? You want this stuff? I spent this money. You got to go earn it. Make sure you post every day. It's also another thing to make sure she has her phone when she's not with me.
Well, and I mean, as far as the pictures, you know, the camera and Instagram account is concerned, that's fostering a creativity. Like, not only do you have the tool, but you have the drive, the reason to use it. And I mean, ultimately, that's going to make her a better photographer as she gets older. That's a great strategy for that.
I introduced her to Adobe Spark the other day, and I didn't get a chance to teach her any of the tools. I was like, oh, here's this app. You know, it does this or that. You can like hype up your pictures and stuff. And then she put her picture up from Snapchat with the little super filter, and then she had the words sliding in. I'm like, oh, okay, you were here, okay. You know, for an 11-year-old, you know, just to give her, because, you know, Adobe stuff is usually overwhelming with all the bells and whistles they got going on. But she, you know, she went in there on her own and she tried. I'm like, oh, good job.
That's so awesome.
The future is obviously technology. She has to be an engineer when she grows up. Her mother's a teacher. She said, oh, I want to be a teacher like my mom. Cool. Teach engineering. No matter what you do, you have to be an engineer. So that's her future. She could be a design engineer, a chemical engineer. I don't care what kind of, she's got to be an engineer.
Yeah.
I'm not going to, again, I don't work that hard. My savings are pretty good, but they're not great. I don't plan on living past like 60, but if I do, I need somebody to make sure I'm in a good home and well taken care of. And a regular school teacher is not going to get that done.
Dr. Morbius in chat says, I want Owen to be my dad.
So, sure.
Are you accepting applications to be
definitely
Chappie's dads?
Okay. I got two more years left. If I don't find somebody and pregnant, I'm about to get a surrogate and just have one more kid. Because I feel like good people should have more kids. I know so many people that are great people that don't have kids. I'm like, you'd be awesome parents. Like, you're not insane. You should have children.
Right.
And they're the ones that are sensical enough to know they don't want kids. They're like, kids cost money and they're going to mess up my travels. No, but you're the good ones. You need to have kids. We need more kids like you.
Right, right.
So definitely about spreading the wealth of childhood. So I'll take you on, doctor.
Yeah, Party from one doctor to the other.
Yeah.
From O-Doctor Dr. Morbius.
And my dad's name, a personal honor to me when he started his own business. He labeled himself Papa Doc. And I felt a little bit of pride in that because I was like, oh, that's cool.
That's great.
That's cool.
That's awesome. Kind of reaching the end of our time here, but I'm curious to ask you, because we've seen a lot of, you know, I mean, we've seen a lot of growth in the technology world. I'm sure, I'm assuming when you were younger, you were a fan of some, you know, types of science fiction. Would you say that the current future is living up to your science fiction fantasies from when you were a kid and you looked forward to 2018? Are you happy with where we are right now, or do you think we could be doing better?
The only thing about technology that is living up to when you're a child, because everything is so fantastical right now.
Absolutely.
Right now, the Marvel Universe is the future of technology. Like, as far as every kid's concerned, they want a spaceship and a laser gun, and they want animanium claws. Like, all that stuff is what they see as the future. But as a kid, the coolest thing I thought would be is cloning. Mm-hmm. Being able to clone yourself. Like, I'm like, man, one day if we could clone ourselves, like, how cool would that be? Like, I could just have two of me, you know? Or, you know, that's the coolest thing. And now that we can clone, but it's like sketchy, and I don't know like how much of it's real, but not real, but is real.
Yeah.
And who is already a clone? like the lizard people. That's my thing in technology. Other than that, we're almost at flying cars, and that's everybody's dream. But before flying cars, I take the Boring Company's idea of burrowing under the ground and just shooting cars like slingshots over flying, because you know we're already screwing up the planet, and flying just means more stuff in the air. So you know the future, as bright as they make it seem, it's not that bright.
Yeah.
When you try to think of all the things they want to say you need to do. Oh, we got the self-lacing Nikes, though.
Yeah, that's, I mean, cool. Those actually happened pretty close to the way it was shown off in Back to the Future. But yeah. I was actually just watching a video earlier this afternoon of a guy, I think a Japanese man who has spent his life, you know, he was obsessed with the Gundam kind of robot, you know, angle of science fiction.
So the exosuits?
Spent his life building up Gundam robots, and you know, and so they show off his latest creation. I mean, it's gigantic. It was built in a warehouse. It was built so tall that it actually can't leave the warehouse because it's too tall to leave out the entrance or whatever. And you know, he's renting it out for parties and stuff for like a grand an hour or whatever, and you can actually get in it and move it around and everything. And it's cool. Like, it's neat that it exists and you can see a Gundam robot robot. Yeah. That you can actually get in and move, but it's just, it's not quite there. And I feel like so much of science fiction that is coming true now, like flying cars, you know, more or less, and all these other things, it's like, yeah, technically we're in the future, but it's just not quite as cool as it looked like it was going to be.
Can I tell you something I'm against? You know, Patrick Behan tried to talk me out of it, but I don't want AI. I don't want artificial intelligence.
I wanted to ask about that, actually. Yeah.
I don't want it in robots. I don't want it at all. I think it is, it's scary. It's freaky. It's a problem. Like, we can't be trusted as human beings. We can't even create human beings that are like everybody. When we get to the Star Trek age, then we can create data, whatever how you say it. But until then, like, when we get peaceful, then we can go creating beings that just start thinking on their own.
Yeah.
Because as far as we are concerned now, we want to kill each other and destroy everything. So if you create a being that's like perfect, they're going to be like, yo, it is going to happen. We need to destroy human beings because they're destroying everything else. And I just don't want to deal with that. So I'm against AI. AI freaks me out. I'm super scared of that future. I don't want it.
Yeah. It definitely seems like AI is being touted as the solution for everything. And
Zuckerberg said AI like 32,000 times.
So many times.
The other day.
So many times. How do you feel?
How great was that interview? you got 90% of grandparents talking about the internet like they don't know what the internet is because they don't. So what do you mean about these cookies? So you follow me or you're not? Is there a switch that I can turn Facebook off like a light? Does Facebook itself like talk to you? Or like, how does Facebook work? I was blown away by some of those questions. And every answer he should have said was, it's free.
Right.
You don't like it, delete it.
Right.
What about it's free. You don't. When he got to the point where he was asking about children, protecting children's privacy. First of all, we already protect children's privacy. Secondly, don't put your funky kid on the app if you're worried about their privacy. Because at the end of the day, you don't pay for Facebook. That's the thing I keep saying. People keep trying to tell me all these things. Oh, and what about the guy who doesn't want to bake the cake for the gay people to go to Supreme Court? Guess what? That guy bakes cakes for money. If you would have went to him and said, bake me this gay cake for free, then he didn't have to do it because you're not paying, but he was going to pay you. Facebook is free. You do not pay for Facebook. And yes, somebody stole your information, whatever. That's why I'm a 63-year-old white man that lives in California on Facebook. People don't know who I am. If you want to hide yourself, go ahead and hide yourself. But Facebook is free. What are you doing, Mark Zuckerberg? I just kept saying, it's free. You don't want it. You don't have to have it. Yes, everybody's on it. But if they're addicted to it, then you guys need to put a bill together to get them rehab from Facebook. Because I don't care. And I threw my papers and I'd have been out. That's what he should have did. But he did.
Hashtag delete Facebook.
Yeah. Are you going to delete Facebook?
Well, I actually stepped away from Facebook. I haven't deleted. I stepped away from it a little more than a year ago. So it was December 2016. Was that right? Yeah. December 2016. I got a little.
And why did you do that?
I started to just get really introspective and creeped out by, I mean, I think it began with Zuckerberg's. To think that the Facebook had any sort of influence over the election is kind of crazy. It began with that statement, which, whether true or not, I felt like was incredibly tone deaf for him to say about his network that obviously has influence, whether he was willing to accept it or not. And I just started to kind of feel like, you know what? I feel icky. Like, I feel like there's a lot that this network can do if you give yourself to it that that can even be smarter than you are, that you think you've got the upper hand when in reality you don't have much control over it at all. And so I stopped using it.
You are an electronic device. You don't get to step away from Facebook because you're worried about what Facebook manipulates. Everything you own is spying on you. Everything you own is listening to you. Everything you own, because you're a digital person, everything you own, your shirts are talking against you to the NSA right now. You don't have to worry about Facebook. Everything is against you. So don't delete. Don't you step back on Facebook and go post some happy cats or something. You be the shining beacon in the world in your stream of technology people, which are probably pleasant people anyway, and on side with you. But you go back to Facebook and you be that shining beacon, because everything you do in your life is sculpted, cultivated, scraped, sold, bought, stored against you. Yep. You can't go anywhere in your normal day without somebody knowing exactly what you're doing, everything you did. So Facebook's okay with me. Like I said, just turn yourself into a 60-year-old black man on Facebook and you'll be fine.
I can't do that, though. It was a long time ago I started it, and I was definitely not that.
Yeah.
I'd have to start with a brand new account.
That's the one thing Uncle Dvorak taught me, is keep my full hat on. Yeah. So I learned early. I get old people ads and stuff for California all the time. Facebook has no idea. They're wasting ad revenue on me.
Good. Owen J.J. Stone, this has been a lot of fun. I'm so happy we could make this work and that you were willing to hop on for a little more than an hour and talk about you. I knew it would be a fun conversation, and I'm so happy to learn more about you.
Yay me, right. Hopefully I still kept the mystery alive.
Yes.
So that nobody knows exactly what's going on in my world, because that's how I like it.
Yes, I mean, I still have some questions in here that are going unanswered, but that's okay, because maybe we can do it again.
Next time, Gadget.
Oh, Doctor, Owen J.J. Stone, where do you want to point people? What do you want people to know as we close things out?
IQMZ, I haven't podcasted in like a month or so. I was sick. I'm back on. I got stuff in the can. So just follow that. Follow me on Twitter, Instagram. And you'll see some stuff that I'm doing if you want to hear me talk about stuff. If you find my email address, you email me. I usually respond. So if you want to yell at me to feel better about yourself, please do that. I'm more than willing to take those emails.
Right on. Owen, keep the dream alive. We'll talk to you soon. And thank you, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Absolutely. This was Triangulation. We do the show every Friday, usually every Friday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, 2200 UTC. We kind of rotate things through. So some weeks you might find me, sometimes Megan Maroney, Leo Laporte, Father Robert Ballesaire, but we're always talking to awesome people. If you go to twit.tv/TRI or twit.tv/triangulation, you can find all the episodes that we've done. At this point, this would be episode number 342. So you've got some catching up to do if you've not seen all of the episodes in the series. This will keep you busy. And you can check it out there, or you can, like I said, catch us live, twit.tv/live every Friday at 3 p.m. Pacific. I'm Jason Howell. We'll see you next week for another awesome episode of Triangulation. Take care, everyone.